the ritualized reading of the Gospel of St. Luke was Sister Angelie's idea. She said it would give wings to the soul and discipline to the body. By the second night, after 10 hours of such close and meditative reading, Sister Mary Joseph Praise suddenly felt print and page dissolve, the boundaries between God and self disintegrated. Reading had brought this, a joyous surrender of her body to the sacred, the eternal, and the infinite.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. In Adam Verghese's new novel, Cutting for Stone, Sister Mary Joseph Praise is a beautiful Indian nun who has a secret affair with a British surgeon named Thomas Stone while working at a missionary hospital in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. She dies while giving birth to twin brothers, Marian and Shiva, and their father disappears shortly afterward. The twins are raised by doctors in the same hospital, and later they also become doctors. The story of their parents' lives and their own intense relationship spans many years and several continents. It's not surprising that the medical profession plays a significant role in the novel, given that Verghese is both a physician and a writer. His first book, My Own Country, was a memoir based on his experiences taking care of AIDS patients in Johnson City, Tennessee, in the 1980s. He followed that with another memoir, The Tennis Partner. Cutting for Stone is his first novel. Verghese discussed Cutting for Stone at the Politics and Prose Bookstore on February 16, 2009.
Thank you very much. It's difficult to decide what to read from a novel. You don't want to give too much away. On the other hand, you don't want it to be utterly mysterious. So I've picked two sections to read from. And I hope to leave a lot of time for us to have a dialogue, to have a little exchange. So I'll read for about 20 minutes or so. The first section I'm going to read is really to do with the character who started this book for me. I had a vision of a very beautiful South Indian nun who had found her way to a mission hospital in Africa. And I had a vision of her suddenly one morning going into precipitous labor. And that is really all I had to begin with. I didn't really know much more about the nun. And perhaps in our discussion we can talk about whether it's a good strategy to begin a book with just a vision like that or whether you need to really know the whole story. In any case, that's all I knew. And the book opens with the scene of her suddenly going into labor. And the story is told by one of the two twins who she gives birth to becomes the narrator for the story. But this particular scene that I'm going to read to you is from 7 years before that precipitous labor. This is a scene when she is first coming across from India to Africa. And she's on a boat called the Kalangut. She's with another nun by the name of Sister Angelie. It's a terrible voyage, a terrible boat, very stormy seas, and that's the part I'm going to read to you. This is the narrator speaking, her son. My mother grew up at the ocean's edge, in sight of the ancient Chinese fishing nets cantilevered from long bamboo poles and dangling over the water like giant cobwebs. The sea was the proverbial breadbasket of her people, provider of prawns and fish. But now, on the deck of the Kalangut, without the Cochin shore to frame her view, my mother did not recognize the breadbasket. She wondered if at its center the ocean had always been this way, smoking, malevolent, and restless. It tormented the Kalangut. It made it pitch and yaw and creak, wanting nothing more than to swallow it whole. She and Sister Angelie secluded themselves in their cabin, bolting the door against men and sea. Angelie's ejaculatory prayers startled my mother. The ritualized reading of the Gospel of St. Luke was Sister Angelie's idea. She said it would give wings to the soul and discipline to the body. By the second night, after 10 hours of such close and meditative reading, Sister Mary Joseph Praise suddenly felt print and page dissolve, the boundaries between God and self disintegrated. Reading had brought this, a joyous surrender of her body to the sacred, the eternal, and the infinite. At Vespers on the second night, on the sixth night, for the two nuns were determined to carry the routine of the convent with them no matter what, they finished a hymn, two psalms, and their antiphons, then the doxology, and they were singing the Magnificat when a piercing, splintering sound brought them to earth. They grabbed their life jackets and rushed out. They were met by the sight of a segment of the deck that had buckled and pushed up into a pyramid. Almost, it seemed to Sister Mary Joseph Praise, as if the Kalangut were made of corrugated cardboard. That seems an appropriate place to stop and not tell you what happens next. And I'm going to leap very far ahead now to a scene involving the twins. So one of the twins is named Marion. He's a boy, but he is named Marion after Marion Sims, who was one of the inventors of the Sims speculum, has a fairly checkered history, but also invented the repair of the fistula that affects women in obstructed labor. And Marion is now recounting this part of the story. It happens many years later when Marion is about 10 years old, and Sister Mary Joseph Praise gets pregnant, as I mentioned. The only evidence of this is her sudden labor. And when she goes into labor, it throws the whole hospital into a big tizzy, this mission hospital. And everyone immediately assumes that Thomas Stone, the surgeon, the English surgeon who's at that hospital, must be the father. And Thomas Stone himself, in his heart of hearts, feels that he must indeed be the father. He does not deny it, but he has absolutely no idea how this could have happened. And you really won't find out till the very last page, I'm afraid. So you will have to read to find that out. And he takes off right after the delivery. And so these two boys are brought up by two Indian physicians who also work in that hospital. And they are Hema, who is an obstetrician gynecologist, and her husband, Dr. Ghosh, who is an internist who has become a reluctant surgeon in that hospital because Thomas Stone has disappeared. And even though he's a reluctant surgeon, one operation that he's always done is the vasectomy. And in this particular scene, he is teaching another physician how to do a vasectomy, and Marion, his son, is observing and reporting. Is reporting the scene. Can you hear me pretty well at the back there? Thank you. I still can't get over how far the crowd goes back there. Remarkable. So Dr. Ghosh is teaching a certain Dr. Cooper, who's from the American Embassy. Dr. Cooper arrived promptly at 8 that evening in an embassy staff car, just as the patient, a Polish gentleman, pulled up in his combi. My father, Dr. Ghosh, had learned the technique of vasectomy as an intern, and he'd learned directly from Dr. Javert in India, whom he spoke of as, quotes, the maestro of male nut clipping, who is personally responsible for millions of people not being here today. The operation was a novelty in Ethiopia, and now expatriate men, particularly Catholics, came to Dr. Ghosh in increasing numbers for an operation that was uncommon or unavailable in their countries. I have a proposition for you, Dr. Cooper, my father said. I shall teach you the vasectomy, and once you are proficient, you can pay me back by doing a vasectomy on a VIP patient. Do I know him? Cooper asked. You are talking to him, Dr. Ghosh said. So you see, I have a vested interest in seeing that you are superbly trained. My assistant, Marion, will help me judge your skills, and Marion, not a word to Hema, you either, Dr. Cooper, about my plans, please. Cooper had a stiff brush cut and overlapping square teeth that looked like chiclets. His American accent was sharp and jarring to the ear, but offset by the way he drawled out his words, by his relaxed, affable manner, as if he'd never had an unpleasant moment in his life and did not expect to. See one, do one, teach one, right, old buddy? Cooper said. Indeed, yes, Ghosh said. It is easy to do, but harder than it looks. Some preliminaries, Dr. Cooper. I tell the patient to use an enema the night before because nothing makes them more tense than being constipated. Warm milk and honey mixed together and put into an enema bag and held shoulder high is what I recommend. Does it work? Does it work, Dr. Cooper? Let me put it this way. If the patient happens to be drinking a whiskey and soda, it'll suck the glass right out of his hand. I promise you, it does really work like that. I also asked the patient to take a warm bath beforehand. It relaxes him. He added softly, and it improves my olfactory experience, you know. The patient had not said a word thus far. He was, Dr. Ghosh had told me, a consultant to the Economic Commission for Africa, an expert on population control, who happened to be the father of five girls. The patient did not mind all the attention. We can't finish if we don't start, so we better start, yes? My father said. Marion, the heater, please. But I had already turned on the electric heater under the table. Here is the first caveat, Dr. Cooper. If you don't want the scrotum to shrivel up and the balls to retract to the armpit, the room has to be really warm. Now, the second caveat is relaxation. Very important. A barbiturate or narcotic might help. I recommend an ounce of Johnny Walker, red or black. I'm not particular. A wonderful relaxant. And yes, you might give one to the patient, too. Cooper's laugh rolled leisurely out of his mouth like the great banks of clouds that spilled over the Entoto Mountains. I hoped that Cooper was paying attention because I had seen this before. When the patient's private parts were exposed, even when the room was warm, the scrotal skin, the dartos muscle, would wrinkle and shrink, and the cremaster muscle would tug the testes up. Then, after a good swallow of whiskey by the patient, which was served only at this point and not before, the sac unfurled. Both surgeons were gloved, and Ghosh cleaned the area thoroughly and then draped sterile towels to frame the field. Do you know what a brinjal looks like, Dr. Cooper? Ghosh asked. I don't believe I do, sir, no. Do you know an aubergine, melanzana, eggplant? Cooper recognized the last word. Well, if you don't meticulously control bleeding, you'll have an eggplant or two. And you know what we call that complication? We call that bloody brinjal and buggerall, so you want to avoid that. I served the patient his Johnny Walker, which he downed in one gulp. I loved assisting Ghosh. Ever since he treated me as if I were old enough to learn and understand, I took my role very seriously. I was thrilled to have Cooper there watching. Dr. Ghosh, on the patient's right, rooted with his thumb and index finger at the top of the scrotum, just where it joined the body. You feel all those wiry things, Dr. Cooper, the lymph vessels, arteries, nerves, whatnot? Well, the vas deferens is in that lot, and with practice, you can tell it apart from all the other wires. It has the largest wall-to-lumen ratio of any tubular structure in the body. Here it is, a whip-like structure. Now put your finger behind mine. Cooper rooted around and said, yep, got it, the vas, yep. Now, Dr. Cooper, push the vas forward from the back with the tip of your index finger. Fix it like this against the pulp of your finger so that it doesn't slip away. Dr. Ghosh's instructions to Cooper were similar to what he said to me when I assisted him. He loved to teach, and in Cooper, he had the kind of student he deserved. If he dazzled Cooper with his polished delivery, it was because he'd practiced it on me. Practicing medicine and teaching medicine were completely connected for Ghosh. When there was no one to instruct, he suffered. But that was rare. He would happily teach a probationer, a family member, even a patient, whoever happened to be around. I use adrenaline with my local anesthetic, Dr. Cooper, to keep the bleeding minimal, and don't be stingy. Any less than 5 cc and your patient will have pain, and the balls will go to the armpit, and you'll have to call a chest surgeon to bring them back down. Now see how my index finger still has the vas stretched over it? I make a tiny cut. I keep pushing on the vas, push it forward, and there, when I see it in the wound, I use an Alice forceps to grab it. He pulled out a short length of white, worm-like tissue. I put a clip here, I put a clip there, I cut between the clips, I remove a 2-centimeter segment. Ideally, you'd send this to pathology. That way, if his wife gets pregnant a year from now, you can show the patient the pathology report, and he'll know it's not because you didn't do your job, but because a third party did their job better. I don't send it to pathology for the simple reason that we don't have a pathologist. But for a while, there was a pathologist at the American Embassy in Beirut. I would do the vasectomies for the American staff, and I would send him these little pieces that I cut out. The man did the pathology for all the American embassies in East and West Africa. He kept sending back reports to me that my specimens were inadequate, that he thought he could see some uroepithelial tissue, but he couldn't be certain if it was the vas. "It's the vas," I wrote back to him. "What other uroepithelial tissue could I have cut out? Call it the vas, please." But he kept complaining, "Cannot be certain it's the vas, not enough tissue." It was starting to annoy me, you know. So finally, I sent him a pair of sheep's balls. I put them in formalin. I sent them off in the same diplomatic pouch with a note saying, "Is this enough tissue?" I never had a problem with him after that. Now, I tie off the ends with catgut, and then I tell the patient, "No communication with wife allowed for the next 90 days. Ghosh turned to face the patient, and he repeated, "No communication with wife allowed for the next 90 days. The patient grinned. "Okay, you can communicate. You can say, 'Good morning, darling,' and all that, but no sex for 3 months. The patient laughed. "Okay, you can have sex, but you must wear a condom." "I use interruptus," the patient said, speaking for the first time in a heavy East European accent. "You use what?" my father said. "Interruptus? Pull and pray? Good God, man, no wonder you have 5 kids. "It's noble of you to try to get off the train at an earlier station, but it is unreliable, sir." "No, sir, interrupt the interruptus unless you want to reach your half dozen this year." The patient looked embarrassed. Dr. Ghosh asked him, "Do you know what we call young men who use coitus interruptus?" The population expert shook his head. "We call them father, daddy, pater, papa." "No, sir, I have done the interrupting for you. Give me 3 months and you can tell your missus that she is not to worry because you will be shooting blanks and there will be no more interruptions and you will be staying for dessert, coffee, and cigars." Thank you very much. I know this has been very painful for some of the men in the room. Someone said the other day that when I was done, there was not a dry seat in the house. Actually, the only reason I choose to read that is it's one of the few really self-contained segments of the book that doesn't need a lot of explanation. So for those of you who are frowning at me, I assure you the whole book is not like that. It's, I'd be very pleased to take your comments and questions now. Don't all speak at once because you'll blow me away.
Will you tell us something about how your writing informs your medical career and how your medical career informs your writing?
How my writing informs my medical career and vice versa. I think it's really been great training to be a physician if you choose to write. I think some of the things that you learn in medical school, especially as an internist, some of the things you learn about observation and trying to put things together and being parsimonious with all your facts to find one explanation, all those are lovely things to know when you're trying to write. But I think the converse is equally true. I think I've learned a lot about myself, about medicine, from writing. I often say that I write in order to find out what I'm thinking. Even if it's an essay that I'm assigned to do or sit down to write, I might have a notion of what it is I think I know about the subject, but writing is very much, to me, a mysterious phenomenon, an act of discovery. And oftentimes in the writing, I stumble onto something that I didn't quite realize. And so with my first two books, they were both cathartic in a certain way, in that they allowed me to understand something about both those topics. And this book, I think, if it's taught me anything, it has reminded me how delightful, to me anyway, as a young kid, the idea of medicine was. How delightful the magic of someone who could look at your body and divine all these things about you. I was just so taken with that. And in writing the book, I had a chance to relive that wonderful sort of excitement of going into medicine and the excitement of practicing medicine, all the very things that I still feel today. So, this writing has certainly influenced my career as a physician. I hope it's given me better insight. Sir.
Yes. What's the genesis of the two nuns from Cochin, and why Ethiopia?
So that's a good question. The genesis of the two nuns, I mean, this is completely fictional. There isn't much of a historical basis for the two nuns, but the way I have them constructed is the Mother Superior of the Carmelite Mission in Madras or Chennai, India, about the time of British independence, she has this notion. She says, you know, if the British could come and colonize India using the East India Company and using Christianity and religion, I'm going to go and carry Christ's word to Africa using my nuns. And so she sends these two young nuns, who are both nuns and nurses, out on this grand, ambitious, and ultimately very foolhardy and dangerous scheme. So it's completely fictional. I don't even know if there's a Carmelite mission in Madras, but it just suited my purposes to have that happen. Yes.
Hi, Abram. Thank you also for inviting me. But that was a wonderful ritual, that teaching of the vasectomy that you just described. And it's probably what we all ought to teach and learn.
The vasectomy specifically? Or
hopefully not. But so how much did you draw from, in writing this book, from your childhood in Ethiopia? Was the missionary hospital, people say people write fiction based on their own experiences.
So the question is, how much did I draw on my own experiences? And, you know, I think that I drew a lot on the geography that I knew well, but there's actually nothing else much in common. I was not a twin. My parents were not physicians. I didn't grow up in a mission hospital. But I did draw on geography. And, you know, I think I'm not shy about, you know, using what I know in a novel. I think ultimately novels, any book, is about truth. You know, and you arrive at some kind of truth. And I'm actually more swayed by the kind of truth in a novel sometimes than a nonfiction book. Dorothy Allison, who I love, says that fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. And so I think that if I have a truth to convey, inevitably it must come from the convictions and beliefs that I have that I then project onto these characters and so on. But it can't be proselytizing. It has to be believable in the construct of the story and so on. So I drew a lot on geography. I drew a lot on my medical experiences and knowledge, but I still had to do a lot of research. I got a lot of textbooks, every textbook in surgery that I could find of the 50s, so that I would know what these characters were reading at that stage in time. And it surprised me how much they knew. It surprised me what had not yet arrived. So, you know, there's still a lot of research involved. I hope that answers your question.
I'm curious what it does to the life of your mind to write fiction as opposed to nonfiction. How you think, what it does to your imagination, how it helps you grow?
Well, I thank you for that. I actually found it very liberating to write fiction. I mean, I wrote two nonfiction books, as I was telling Carla earlier today. My first published work, just about my first work, was a New Yorker short story. And when it was published, I thought, okay, I've arrived. I'm on the course to publish more fiction. But when the New Yorker editors got to know a bit about my background and that I was a physician working with AIDS in rural America, they asked me for a nonfiction proposal for a long piece, I thought, in the New Yorker, and I was so excited by that. The New Yorker pays about $1 a word, and I thought 100,000 words would be just right for them. And sadly, they turned me down. They didn't take that particular piece. They took other things, and I was left with a book proposal, and I had to sort of learn how to write nonfiction, and it was very edifying. I systematically read all the great nonfiction writers I could think of, because when I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I have colleagues from the workshop here, we never discussed nonfiction. It was all fiction. So I started reading Naipaul and Nabokov and George Orwell, and I really got a sense of what the standard was, and then set about trying to write it. And I found there were two advantages to writing nonfiction. One is your story was, in a sense, laid out for you, by and large. You had to rearrange, dramatize, organize, but you kind of knew the subject, or thought you did. The second thing was that because it really happened, the reader has an inherent interest in the subject. And you know, it's powerful. I mean, you to have a book where the reader has an interest before they even open the page because it really happened is no small thing. I thought that was just tremendously helpful. So, to give you an example, if I make up a story about a African-American a child who excels as an athlete, goes to high school, wins a college scholarship for football, and then goes on to win the Heisman Trophy, and then goes to the NFL, has a stellar career, marries a beautiful blonde woman, has two children, then becomes estranged, winds up slaughtering her and her boyfriend in the driveway of their Brentwood home, then takes off on a chase in a white Bronco down the freeway, then gets captured, then acquitted. As fiction, this is tawdry. This is not halfway interesting. But because it really happened, look how much time you and I spent on that story. So that was the great advantage of nonfiction, is that it happened, and so the reader has an interest in it. What I found with fiction is it's very liberating. I can make anything I want up, but I have to work 10 times harder to keep the reader and make them forget in the first page that they're reading this made-up story and have them enter this world and never let them down until 500 pages later. So that's a real challenge, and you make some very hard decisions about, you know, killing pieces of writing that really are not bad at all, but they don't serve this purpose, and so you kill them mercilessly, or your editor does, one of the two.
One of the themes in my own country, and I believe you touched on it again today in the interview with Mr. Thompson, was the comparison or contrast between healing and curing. And I just wondered if you'd talk just for a minute about that.
Yeah, I think the question about healing and curing is one I often bring up with medical students, and it immediately sounds hokey. It immediately sounds like I'm going to get into something really hokey, and I quickly try and give them an example of the distinction between healing and curing. I tell them, imagine you go back from your class today and go to your house and find that your door's been kicked in and all your belongings have been stolen. Stuff is strewn around. They've taken your computer, your money, your jewelry, your iPod, God forbid, they took your iPod too. You would be devastated. You would be devastated. And if the police come by an hour or two later and say, we found the person who did this, here's all your stuff back, you will be cured, but you will not be healed. Your sense of violation will linger. In fact, you might even move from that apartment just because of that sense of violation. And I argue that all illness has a physical component, the door being broken down, things lost, but also has a tremendous spiritual component of feeling violated. And I think with cancer, with HIV, the sense of violation was huge. And a very humbling lesson of my early years as an HIV physician was when I had nothing to offer is precisely when I had everything to offer, by learning to leave the confines of the hospital and engage with the patient in their homes, at the bedside. And so that's the distinction that I think I was referring to with Bob, but he may have put it better than I just did. And maybe this is a great place to close down with, sure, with a quote from Yeats, which was, because I sense it's getting warm and the hour is late, and I'll be happy to speak to you privately after this. But there was a quote from Yeats that really has been operative in my life. I've not been the best example of following it, but I think it's the dichotomy that I set up in the novel, and that is, Yeats says, the intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or perfection of the work. And if it chooses the latter, must forego a heavenly mansion raging in the dark. And so I think what is global, what is universal, I think, is all of us trying to balance the search for meaning with our obligation to family, our obligation to self. And it was that contrast, that duality, that interested me very much. I also wanted to point out how, you know, medicine is hugely attractive, I think, to young people. I'm amazed that anybody would apply for anything but medical school, but that's just my bias. And I had no head for math, so there was really very few other options for me. But I also think that it's a danger, that there's a great danger that in entering medicine, you completely lose yourself and wind up, hurting the people you most don't want to hurt and hurting yourself, but following the greatest precepts of your profession. So that was the dichotomy I hoped to set up the most.
Thank
you so much for all coming tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.